It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Little Richard, best known for his flamboyant style and hit songs, including Tutti Frutti and Good Golly Miss Molly, passed away over the weekend at the age of 87. Coming up, we'll look at the mark he left on the music industry and popular culture. First, as the global COVID-19 pandemic has dominated the news, other public health issues have seemingly fallen through the cracks, including the ongoing opioid crisis. Opioid drugs include prescription painkillers like Oxycontin and illegal narcotics like heroin. These drugs have the capacity to become highly addictive, and for a period of time, many overdose deaths have been attributed to these opioids. But what's happening with the opioid crisis now as our attention is turned to fighting the novel coronavirus? Our next guest joins us to talk about the challenges facing doctors and patients seeking help with addiction during a pandemic. Dr. Chris Eberlein is an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. Dr. Eberlein, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me today.
What kind of changes have you seen over the last couple months during this COVID-19 outbreak as far as how it might affect treatment for addiction?
Well, I think the most concerning part is we've seen locally here in La Crosse County a 63% increase year-to-date in deaths contributed to overdoses. And I think that's really due to a multitude of factors, including the fear and anxiety, depression, and everyone in general, especially those that struggle with their mental health issues that even prior to the pandemic. But additionally, you know, economic losses, social isolation, and those needing increased social support that they're not getting.
How about access to treatment? Is it harder for people who might have had some kind of treatment program, whether that's a group counseling session or individual appointments? Is it harder for them to get to that kind of help?
Yeah, I think that's for sure been something we've been seeing as well. As a lot of patients have been going to virtual visits, some of these patients don't have that ability for cost and technology. And a lot of their regular routine visits were canceled. So I think these are all playing a role in the increased overdoses.
Before the pandemic outbreak, what were we seeing when it came to trends with addiction to opioids here in Wisconsin?
Well, locally in La Crosse, we actually had a downward trend. We were down to 22 deaths in 2019, and that was been steadily going down over the last 4 or 5 years. So this is a definite change in what we had been seeing.
What kind of resources would you point people toward right now if someone is out there listening, saying, hey, I or a loved one need help with this?
Well, I think people have to realize that you can still seek professional help as you need it. The openings in clinics are there. They're coming back online now. The virtual visits are available. And obviously, if you have a crisis in mental health or addiction, you need to go to the emergency care. And please don't hesitate to seek out your emergency department. The healthcare systems really do have safety in place for COVID patients, so we can take care of all patients.
Talking to Dr. Chris Eberlein from Gunderson Health System. He's an emergency physician there, and he's worked on issues related to opioid addictions. Dr. Eberlein, I want to follow up on that point. I've heard from guests on this show and elsewhere this concern that people with acute medical conditions, whether related to addiction or mental health or signs of stroke or heart attack, some people might be worried about going to their emergency room when they need it. Your message, it sounds like, is the same as their message. If you need emergency help, seek it.
For sure. You shouldn't hesitate. If you're having an emergency or seek and need emergency care, don't hesitate. We are able to take care of all patients right now.
Now, getting back to opioids in particular, a lot of the story a while back was prescription medications. And then we also heard about, off-label or illegal use of those prescription medications and then people turning to heroin. What are some of the latest things you have seen when it comes to how people are getting these opioids?
Yeah, we've definitely seen a switch from prescription drugs to more of the illicit fentanyl, even fentanyl more than heroin, at least locally. And the prescription drug abuse has gone down quite a bit in the last few years. And I think that's largely contributed to the PDMP and better prescribing practices. But that has caused a shift as that supply has dried up to patients seeking out the other illicit drugs, in particular fentanyl, because that's become cheaper and more widely available.
And when it comes to overdose deaths, my understanding, Dr. Eberlein, is that fentanyl in particular is particularly risky, along with heroin for that matter, because from one dose to another, people just don't know how strong a dose they're getting. Is that still true?
That is still true. You know, each time that these patients use these drugs, they really don't know the quality of drug, how much drug is actually in that dose. You know, they're not getting it from your routine pharmacist, so these are not drugs that you can know what you're really getting. I've had patients that have thought they were using meth and it was heroin or fentanyl, and so they weren't even ready for that type of overdose, so we've been seeing that kind of mix as well.
What do we know about effective treatments for people who are trying to end or control an opioid addiction?
Well, you know, no treatment typically is the same for each patient. Everyone needs a little bit of tailored care in this disease. And so there is, counseling is very important, obviously. You can't do that without. And then you've got medication-assisted treatments as well. And all these have been shown to be effective. But you've got to really seek out someone who can work with you and get you on the proper treatment program.
When it comes to access to these kind of treatments, and again, people might have to move from one to another before they find the one that's effective for them. Do we have enough? Do we have enough access to the methadone and similar products and counseling services and things like that?
Yeah, access has always been an issue, and we've really expanded access in the last couple of years, but it is still something that we struggle with, getting patients in a timely manner. So when I think of access, I think of if it's your day to get sober, you can call and get an appointment and get treated that day. We're not to the point yet where that is universal for all of our patients. We're getting close, but we're not there yet.
Now, COVID-19, it's a real deal. It's a real problem. But are you concerned that we're taking our eye off the ball as we look at this one big public health emergency and maybe are overlooking this other serious public health problem?
That's always a concern. And, and like I said, I think that COVID has thrown a lot of curveballs at the medical system in general. So we really have to keep looking at ways that we don't let patients fall through the cracks. And as clinic visits get back online, more virtual visits, I think there's opportunities to get all these patients seen in a timely manner. These are really vulnerable patients, and it's something that we really have to keep working at to make sure that they don't fall through the cracks.
Dr. Chris Eberlein is with us, an emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. He's with us to talk about the opioid crisis and how, as a public health issue, may have fallen through the cracks during the coronavirus pandemic. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the opioid crisis? If you have a personal story to share, as someone who sought treatment yourself or have a loved one who is seeking treatment now, let us know how it's going for you. If you work on the treatment side of things, love to hear from you as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the opioid crisis and the impact COVID-19 is having on doctors and patients. Dr. Chris Eberlein is with us, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the opioid crisis and treatment here in Wisconsin? What do you want to know about how doctors and patients are handling it during the COVID-19 outbreak? And if you have a story to share, either your own or someone in your family of seeking treatment, is it more difficult now with concerns over the virus? Or if you're in on the treatment side of things yourself, you can also join in. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Eberlein, we've talked to you in the past about methamphetamine as well, and different communities around the state have different levels of problems with opioids versus meth. What are you seeing with that in the last few months?
Yeah, meth has been a constant struggle for the whole state, and in particular our region as well. The amount of meth that we see is fairly constant. It's been there all along. We see it often mixed with fentanyl and other opioids on the toxicology reports of those that have overdosed. So we know that there's a lot of mixing of these drugs. Whether the addict actually knows that they're getting meth and they thought they were just getting fentanyl or heroin, that remains to be seen.
We've seen, getting back to opioids in particular now, over the years here in Wisconsin, packages of legislation aimed at providing help with dealing with the opioid epidemic. We recently had another of what's been called the HOPE agenda. What kind of changes have you seen over the years here in Wisconsin at the state level that might be making a difference here?
We've done a lot in the state, and I really commend the whole state for what they've done on this epidemic of opiate abuse. But some of the biggest things we've done is supporting our PDMP and making sure that we're not giving too many prescriptions, because we knew at the beginning of this that 80% of heroin addicts were starting with prescription drugs. So we fix that by having the PDMP where everyone puts in, it's a, basically a registry of all prescription drugs. So a provider can look up and see where the patient's been getting drugs from as far as prescription drugs go. And the other things they've been supporting, MAT, drug take-back days have been huge, getting them out of our houses. And the needle exchange programs have been very helpful in distributing Narcan, which has also been obviously a life-saving drug, getting that out in the communities as well.
And we've talked in the past about the critical moment when someone who's maybe been addicted to prescription medications, maybe obtained legally at first, illegally after, when that supply is cut off, do we have interventions at that moment to make sure they get some kind of treatment and don't end up looking for the fentanyls or the heroines on the street?
Yeah, we're definitely working towards that end. Like I said, we want to get it to the point. The perfect system is when that patient wants to get help, you can get help that moment. Some communities are very close. Some have it, depending on the day, but it is not a universal across the state that we have that ability. So that is the ideal scenario. And not only getting the treatment you need, whether it be MAT or counseling, but the social support too. Because a lot of these patients, you know, whether it be your underlying mental health, you know, the living scenario you're in. So we don't want them to get sober and go right back to that same routine, same friends, same environment that really sets these patients up for failure. And we want to break that cycle as well.
How is social distancing affecting all of this? You mentioned that the feeling of isolation could be exacerbating mental health problems that might make an overdose more likely. Is it, and maybe it's too soon to tell, or maybe this isn't being tracked, is it disrupting the flow of these medications? Is it disrupting networks of distribution?
Well, unfortunately, looking at the overdose deaths, I don't think it's affecting distribution of illicit drugs. But I do think it is affecting some of the social support some of these patients need. In addition, looking at the number of overdoses we're seeing that weren't given Narcan, I also worry that some of the, more patients are utilizing their drugs alone and not using a buddy system. So no one's there to give them Narcan if they overdose.
Are you seeing any public health efforts to try to overcome that? I don't know what that would be, but to try to make sure people aren't left alone and have access to Narcan if needed.
Yeah, we're trying to get that message out. We've distributed a lot of Narcan throughout the state, and so Narcan is available, but the patient has to seek it out. So to encourage them to continue to seek that out and to continue to use as safe as you can use some of these drugs. You know, they're not safe drugs to begin with, but having someone else there, knowing what you're using, and available to call 911 and give you Narcan is really important.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your capacity as an emergency physician, a little bit out above and beyond the opioid addiction issue. What kind of things are we seeing in emergency rooms in the area? Are you seeing that you know, those unexpected absences of the people showing up with symptoms because people are avoiding emergency rooms during COVID-19?
Yeah, there has been nationally and locally a reduction in patients coming in to seek care, whether that be in urgent care or emergency departments, and obviously in their primary care as well. And whenever you get that, you end up having patients that have chronic disease that end up in an acute crisis. And so what we're seeing is lower volumes but higher acuity. Now, nationally, you're seeing some areas that are having 50 to 80% increase in out-of-hospital cardiac arrests because patients aren't coming in. Fortunately, at least in the La Crosse area that I track, our numbers have not been that dramatic, although in the last month we have had more heart attacks. They have not died, but people coming in with what we call ST elevation myocardial infarctions, those that have to go directly to the heart catheterization lab. So we usually see a few a month. In April, we actually saw almost double what we normally see. So that is a concerning trend. The numbers aren't huge, so it's hard to make a statistical analysis on that, but definitely something we're watching.
Can you leave us with, in our last minute or so, a message for people? What kind of symptoms, especially when it comes to those heart, cardiac, stroke issues, what kind of symptoms should get them to the emergency room right away?
Yeah, anytime you're having any chest pain or any neurological complaints, whether it be difficulty speaking or weakness, anything that you would have thought that was an emergency prior to COVID, it is still an emergency. And do not delay seeking care because you're afraid of the virus. This is something that we have great, robust policies and procedures in place to protect all of our patients. We also protecting our staff. So your risk of having a complication from that emergent medical crisis is much higher than the risk of the virus.
Dr. Eberlein, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. You have a great day.
You too. That's Dr. Chris Eberlein, emergency physician at Gunderson Health System based in La Crosse. He joins today to talk about a couple things, the ongoing opioid crisis in Wisconsin, how it's become more complicated during the COVID-19 outbreak, and also with some general messages on emergency treatment here in Wisconsin. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a new series of audio diaries called Outbreak Wisconsin. The federal stimulus package passed more than a month ago includes an extra $600 per week for people who are receiving unemployment benefits. Wisconsin began distributing the extra money at the end of April with the expectation that it would take about a week and a half to pay everyone. Madison bartender Amy Moreland has been out of work since mid-March. Since we last checked in with her, she has spent a lot of time waiting for the extra $600.
Hello, this is Amy Moreland, and today is Wednesday, April 29th. I'm at my home in Madison. It's a rainy day out today, which is kind of nice because it makes me feel not bad for not doing very much. And again, I am completely unemployed, so I don't have much of a routine at all. I woke up this morning and made breakfast, had a cup of coffee, and looked at some things about unemployment. Right now, as of we have last talked, I get $100 a week for unemployment. I am hoping to get the extra $600, which I have some friends in other states, so I know that my friend in Chicago is getting it, and she has been for a couple weeks, so that gives me a lot of hope. They did say that it was going to come on the week of the 24th. It's the 29th now. Their website has just been updated to say that in order to catch up, they need until May 8th, which doesn't leave me with a lot of confidence. The fact that other states have gotten it gives me confidence, but the fact that, you know, we were supposed to get it 3 days ago, and now they're saying that it could be till May 8th, 3 days after it was supposed to be in our accounts, is scary, because it just seems like maybe on May 8th, it will be like, oh, sorry, actually, it's going to be two more weeks. And I, you know, I've said time and time again that I feel very lucky in my situation, though, even though I'm extremely poor, I did have a savings account that I completely drained in order to pay my rent and most of my bills for a couple months to give me some breathing room. There's so many questions that I have about unemployment, but there's no way to talk to anyone. You can call 100 times a day and you can get put on hold. And then I've been on hold for 8 hours before and then just like kicked off. But, yeah, that is my update for the day. This is Amy Moreland, and today is May 5th, 2020, and I got my first payment of $600, the extra $600 that we've all been waiting for. None of the back pay yet, but I don't know. There's still some people that haven't got it, but right now I have it, so I'm feeling pretty hopeful. I'm about to jump on my computer and pay some bills, pay some internet, and maybe even buy some groceries. It's exciting day. So yeah, just checking in day 54. And finally, some financial relief.
This story is part of Outbreak Wisconsin, a new series from WPR and Wisconsin Watch. Coming up after the news, we'll look back at the life and legacy of rock and roll pioneer Little Richard. We'll get a taste of some of his music and check out his place in the history of rock and roll music and culture. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin's DNR warned of high fire danger risk going into this past weekend in much of the state. We talked to a wildfire prevention specialist about the risks facing Wisconsin. First, one of the founders of rock and roll passed away this weekend. Known for his flamboyant style, ferocious piano playing, and gospel-inspired vocal exclamations, Little Richard described himself as the king and queen of rock and roll. He turned out a string of hits in the mid-1950s, including Tutti Frutti, Long Tall Sally, and Lucille, before going off to rediscover his faith. In the years that followed, he dipped in and out of show business. The New Yorker said he was more of a comet than a planet, and that, quote, the trail of light that he left behind was and is everywhere. Little Richard died Saturday of bone cancer at the age of 87. And look back at his life and musical legacy with Alexander Shashko. He's a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, frequent guest with us to talk about music. Alexander, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, Little Richard said he was a main founder of rock and roll, and there's a pretty good case to be made for that, isn't there, Alexander?
Absolutely. He is one of the guiding lights of rock and roll, alongside Elvis Presley and Chuck Berry, Sister Rosetta Tharpe, a handful of other artists. He is one of the figures who really came to define what rock and roll was all about. The way that he sung, the way that he wrote songs, the way that the songs were produced and recorded, all became standard bearers for what rock and roll would be for generations of rock and roll artists who followed him.
Now, part of the legacy is the music, but part of it is also the, I just feel like the energy he brought to his performances that you can see in so many genres, you know, punk and metal and others over the years. You get the sense that he wasn't leaving anything on the table when he performed.
That's absolutely right. You know, even before he was a recording artist, his friends and family, people who heard him in the church, would all talk not just about how distinctive his voice was, but just how loud he was, that he actually just had a really, really loud voice. And he wasn't afraid to use it, right? He wasn't afraid to express the exuberance of life and the exuberance of the world through the loudness of his voice, through the range that he had, through the willingness that he had to express himself by bending and shaping notes, those squeals, those screams that were part of his singing style. They all came together to create a sense of rebellion, but also a sense of joy that, that again, really did come to be one of the main ways in which rock and roll artists, soul musicians, rock and punk artists later on would use their own voices.
Now, the origins of rock music, they brought together a lot of threads. What threads do you see coming together in Little Richard's early hits?
Well, I think that there were a number of different threads that were there. Certainly, the church was central to it. He had grown up around Pentecostal and other religious sounds, and so gospel is right there at the center of his singing. The blues was there, too. He really started his recording career before he became the Little Richard we all know as a blues singer. And so he was around the blues, and female blues singers in particular were really influential in his singing style. On top of all of that, you had the boogie-woogie piano playing that had become so popular sort of via the jump blues and in New Orleans in the early 1950s. But he took that a little further. He took the boogie-woogie style, which definitely had a kind of swing to it where not every note was the same length, and sped it up and made it even more sort of repetitive. And so that way in which he would slam on the piano, he and Jerry Lee Lewis would really create that sound, that piano sound that would become incredibly influential later on. So you had all of these different influences, along with the fact that he had toured when he was younger with various medicine shows, with drag queen shows, with comedy tours, music tours, and he brought all of the different musical influences and frankly, showbiz tricks that came with that world into the way in which he performed and wrote his music.
Let's listen to a piece of another Little Richard hit, Good Golly, Miss Molly. One measure of influence is how often songs are covered, I think. And Little Richard, a lot of bands, the Beatles and, just, I don't know, Mitch Ryder and so many others covered his hits over the years.
They did. They were recorded by a lot of different artists, especially those rock and roll artists of the 1960s who had grown up listening to them. And even more artists would perform them live. They had such great energy. They were so fast. And they were so exciting that even if it wasn't a song that they had recorded, they would often go and perform them. And that was really a tribute to the way in which Little Richard was not only writing songs that influenced how they would write songs later on, but also how his performance and the style really became part of how those future artists, so the artists that followed him, would also perform. I mean, the Beatles were incredibly influenced by Little Richard. Without Little Richard, those screams that Paul McCartney lets out really don't happen. And he openly has acknowledged that and mentioned it again after Little Richard's passing the other day, that he learned that not just through listening to the records as a kid, but also by opening up for Little Richard and touring with him early on in their careers. And so they actually got to know him a little bit and Paul McCartney really actually learned directly from Little Richard how to do that. So, yeah, the influence of those songs and the way in which they've been covered has gone on for generations, and a lot of punk artists would perform those songs as well. because they had that speed, that sense of recklessness, which really was part of what punk was about as well.
Talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison about a Little Richard. He passed away, Little Richard, over the weekend, looking at his influence and the origins of rock music. Another part of the story is his persona, the flamboyant clothes, the sexuality on stage and in the music, his fluid sexual identity over the years. Can you talk about that and how it may have set a standard for performers in decades to come?
That is absolutely true. And in some ways, the way in which Little Richard's persona was carried forth by future generations of musicians and performers may be a legacy as great, if not greater, in our present day as the music itself. But it goes all the way back to the beginning. At the very beginning, Little Richard's greatest competitor on the live circuit in Georgia was James Brown. And James Brown and Little Richard would often essentially compete, sometimes on the very same stage on the very same night, and learned a lot from one another. And James Brown openly would talk about how he, you know, started to do his hair in a way that could compete with Little Richard, would wear more flamboyant clothing, would put on a show, essentially, in order to keep up with what Little Richard was doing. But of course, this story and this legacy goes forward even further than that. The way in which there was a kind of androgynous, gender-bending style to what Little Richard was doing is something that Mick Jagger picked up from Little Richard. The strut, the way in which he sort of performed, had that connection. Even more direct was David Bowie, who would openly acknowledge that connection to Little Richard and the way that his androgyny would play out in his performances. And then you had Prince, who, you know, really embodied a lot of Little Richard's style and persona in the 1980s and 1990s. If you look at the cover, for example, of Parade, one of Prince's albums, he's got the pencil mustache, he's got the bouffant hair, he's got all of these elements that is an open homage to Little Richard. And so that flamboyance, that style, the androgyny was all a big part of it, as of course was Little Richard being a standard bearer for people in the LGBTQ community from that point forward. Of course, in the 1950s, that was widely, you know, his sexuality was widely frowned upon, and he struggled with it throughout his life, going to the church to find refuge, leaving the church and returning to live performing, going back and forth. He was always rather coy about how he talked about it. But the listeners didn't have that kind of ambivalence, especially if it was something to which they could relate directly. And so he leaves that legacy as well of bringing homosexuality into the dynamic of popular culture via rock and roll.
I want to give a listen to Little Richard talking to NPR in 1984, talking about his time in the 70s, drinking, doing drugs, losing his younger brother and two of his friends killed. This is him talking about, as you were just talking about, turning to faith.
And then I said, well, God is trying to tell me something. Then the thought came to me, what shall it profit a man if he should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? And I decided that I would give my life to God.
And we had this back and forth, Little Richard turning to the faith and then turning back to music, identifying himself as gay or omnisexual, and then anti-LGBT at some points. He was a constant work in progress, personally, it seems.
Well, I think at a couple levels, society let him down. And I'll say, first of all, of course, when it came to his sexuality, society and the fact that society was unwilling to embrace his sexuality and LGBTQ rights in general in the 50s and 60s and well beyond that, made it difficult for him to embrace it publicly himself. He was a creature of that era in that sense. But it's also the fact that those early 1950s performers, as the excitement of early rock and roll, as the fear that it instilled in people, as the sort of sense of rebellion that it created, as that all subsided into the 1960s, there wasn't really anywhere for those 50s artists to go. Today, we have a whole infrastructure for popular artists to help sustain and lengthen their careers, to keep them going as musical styles change from one era to another. He didn't really get to experience any of that. And as a result, even though in the 1960s he had a comeback, He played in England. There were certainly, those artists were certainly acknowledging his importance. By the time you get into the 1970s, there's nowhere for his career to go. And as a result, I think a lot of the struggle that he had came from the fact that he had nowhere to channel the art. He had nowhere to channel the talent that he had because the institutions really kind of let him down.
As we wrap up, Alexander, what do you think people, music fans maybe in particular, should take away from the life and art of Little Richard?
I would tell everyone that what they should take away is the sense of possibility in his music, the way in which he was willing to cross and obliterate boundaries and to do it with a sense of joy and excitement, that the lines between black and white culture, gay and straight culture, between the South and the North, between the church and the secular world, between masculinity and femininity, all of those things were categories that he was willing to challenge, he was willing to absorb, he was willing to experiment with, and in the process created a different way for us to hear and understand the world. And I think that when you listen to those three-minute songs, as simple as they may be, that's really the lesson to take away.
Alexander, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you very much.
Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison. We talked to him about the life and legacy of rock and roll pioneer Little Richard, who died on Saturday at the age of 87. Coming up, Wisconsin is entering the peak of its wildfire season. We learn about how specific conditions this year are impacting our threat level. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers is out with safety recommendations for businesses as they get ready to reopen this month. We'll take a closer look with the head of the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. First, several weeks ago, Governor Evers declared a state of emergency in Wisconsin because of the risk of wildfires. Let's give a listen to some radio traffic from the Wisconsin DNR related to a 200-acre fire in Juneau County last month.
Yeah, quite a bit of smoke. Not sure how big it is. You know where patrol is.
After that, we're going to send South Patrol is out of Adams right now.
Mesita 61, Black River. Rapid South Patrol's in Adams. He'll be taking off in a couple minutes.
Yeah, I don't know how many acres we got on fire. I want to guess 20, 30, 40 acres.
And going into this past weekend, the DNR considered the danger levels for fires to be high to very high in big parts of the state. Catherine Cooley is a wildfire prevention specialist with the Wisconsin DNR. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Appreciate being here, Rob. Thank you.
Well, Catherine, I know conditions can change pretty quickly in the state. Can you give us kind of a census of our risk of wildfire around Wisconsin right now?
So, you know, over the weekend, we did have some pretty elevated fire on Saturday. So we were at very high, and we had about 16 fires across the state in DNR protection areas. We did have a little reprieve yesterday and today with that light scattered rain. But the fire danger is still pretty elevated in the northern half, particularly in the sandy soils and the pine areas.
And I understand there's an extra concern this year, not necessarily because of the risk level in and of itself, but the additional risk it could put firefighters at during the COVID-19 outbreak. Can you talk about why we're being a little extra special careful this year?
Absolutely. You know, like everyone dealing with this pandemic, we had to take a very proactive approach. And we, you know, the fire program is very accustomed to dealing with crises. So we did not waste any time. We knew going into this at the end of March that we had to take some necessary steps to keep the public and our firefighters very safe. So we developed a wildfire response plan, and that took into account the suspension of burning permits as well as prescribed fires. And then in addition to that, you know, all the safety measures that our firefighters have to take when fighting fire and also dealing with the public.
Now, I know a lot of the national attention on wildfires is out west, the Californias and the Northwest, places like that. Can you talk about how much damage we can experience here in Wisconsin when it comes to wildfires?
You know, I think the first thing to recognize is the fact that Wisconsin does have a fire season. And typically when we see the activity out west, it's in the summer, in the late summer. And I think folks need to understand that fire season in Wisconsin is in the spring. So shortly after that snow cover disappears to when things green up. And what we're seeing this year in particular is because of these little bit cooler temps that we've had over the last couple days, The greening of vegetation, primarily in the northern part of the state, is a little bit slower right now. So we are anticipating a slightly longer fire season ahead.
What is the usual run of the fire season here in the state?
So we usually wrap up kind of our fire season with staffing, you know, heavy staffing, usually by Memorial Day. So, you know, with the anticipation, we had a call with our fire managers this morning and discussed the progression of green up. It looks like the southern portion of the state is greening very nicely, but we're seeing in some of those sandy soils and under the pine areas, the grasses are not greening as they normally are this time of year. So we're thinking that we will be staffing over Memorial Day weekend this year.
Talking to Catherine Cooley, wildfire prevention specialist with the Wisconsin DNR, talking about wildfire season in Wisconsin, which is now, and what the state and the public can do to help prevent wildfires. How do firefighters and agencies gear up this time of year, Catherine?
You know, I think it's with everything going on, especially I'll tie it back to COVID, you know, we are an all hands on deck. You know, we didn't know what the future was going to hold, and we had to be fire ready. We didn't know if we were going to be impacted staffing wise. And that's also in the fire department community as well, and our partners. So we had to be able to kind of help each other. It is truly an all hands on deck. And as you can see, the fire danger, you know, changes from the southern part of the state to the north. So we like to pre-position equipment accordingly. And we also bring in contracted single engine air tankers. So we currently have four of those scattered in our high fire danger areas across the state. And in addition to the executive order that the governor put in place, we also have access to the Black Hawk helicopters, Army National Guard Black Hawk helicopters with bucket capability.
What is your message for members of the public to help prevent wildfires, you know, in general, but this year in particular?
You know, I was thinking about this, and an analogy I'd like to use is a lot of people like to burn their debris in the spring, which is the number one cause of wildfires in Wisconsin. So folks who are outside and we're all home, cleaning up our yards, and that's great. Get outside, enjoy those beautiful days, cleaning up your yard, but just hold off on burning those things. I was thinking in terms of it like haircuts. You know, a couple of us could probably use some haircuts right now. It's unsightly. Debris piles in the yard are probably unsightly, but you know, we can live without burning those. And that's the reality of it. If folks could just kind of wait until things are a little bit safer, the fire danger subsides and things really green up, that would really help everybody.
So if there's that person listening at home, they've got that debris piled back there, they think, oh, I usually burn it this time of year. How long should they let that sit there for now?
So my recommendation is, you know, put a tarp over it. Wait till things really green up and are lush. And you can check our website for the current fire danger. We update it daily by 11 a.m. And check with your local fire officials. They're here to help. They can give you advice on what to do. And also just consider alternatives to burning. There are, you know, transfer sites available. You can leave it in the woods for wildlife to enjoy. So, you know, burning is not the only option.
And what is that website? Where can people find that to find that that map?
So go to the DNR homepage and search fire.
Pretty straightforward. Now, people are, I think, hoping and looking forward to traveling to different parts of the state, especially going up north where, as you said, the fire danger, it sounds like, lasts longer than the southern part of the state. Assuming they could travel in maybe a few weeks, what's your message to them about fire caution?
You know, I actually live in the northern part of the state, and we have seen a lot of activity up here already. And I think, you know, we do, you know, there is a little bit of that complacency that can come into play here because of the southern half is going to be a little more green and less of a risk. So as you come north, make sure you know what the fire danger is, know what the restrictions are, any permit requirements, use a lot of caution. You know, the DNR is not restricting small campfires for warming or cooking. So just make sure that, you know, you keep an eye on that fire danger, avoid burning on those really critical days, you know, when things get into that high, very high range, or especially extreme. And make sure that those fires are out because the fire danger can change very quickly from day to day. And it's important to make sure that any previous fires are put out so they don't rekindle.
Catherine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to DNR wildfire prevention specialist Catherine Cooley. We talked to her today about peak wildfire season in Wisconsin, which is now, especially in the northern parts of the state, and what we can do to prevent additional fires. By the way, we've got a link to the map she was talking about showing the whole state and what the current level of fire danger is, updated daily, I think she said. You can find a link over at WPR.org/Central Time. And if you are being a little extra careful this year when it comes to fires because of the risk to firefighters because of COVID, or if you are someone who fights wildfires yourself, share your story with us. Email ideas@WPR.org. Since the coronavirus shutdown started, we've been sharing some entertainment options available online, since we can't always do things in person so much right now. Things like online Shakespeare performances from famous companies around the world, to readings of Harry Potter by Daniel Radcliffe and other stars, to weird museum contests to find the creepiest item in an exhibit. Here's another one from the world of pop culture. A lot of offices are using online software to stay in touch, like Teams and Slack and whatnot. One website flipped things around with Office software. They are recreating the entire run of the Office TV show using Slack. All 201 episodes of The Office apparently being recreated line by line on the chat application. I haven't dug in too deep, but their sample includes this scene in Slack form where Michael calls in needing help after an injury.
Ooh, I burned my foot very badly on my Foreman grill, and I now need someone to come and bring me into work.
You burned your foot on a Foreman grill.
It actually works pretty well as an online chat. In other news related to that show, the cast of The Office recently crashed an online wedding. Star John Krasinski has been hosting an online video series called Some Good News. When he saw an online video of a couple that reenacted an on-screen marriage proposal from The Office, he gathered about a dozen castmates to join the online marriage ceremony and recreated some of their dance moves from the show. Pop culture news you can use. This is Central Time.